WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Chancellor got into TV so early, he didn't even own a TV yet. Chancellor was a pioneer in the development of network TV news. During his 40 years at NBC, Chancellor has reported from 50 different countries, covered every presidential election since 1956, and was the anchorman for the NBC Nightly News for 12 years. He's now the senior commentator and senior political analyst for NBC News. Chancellor has expanded on his role as news analyst and written a book that he calls A Commentary on America. It's titled Peril or Promise. I asked John Chancellor if it was difficult for him to change from being an objective reporter into a commentator who takes a point of view.
Yes. The first commentaries for about a year were like lawyer's briefs because I believed I had to prove everything. And then I began to relax a little bit. And it is a big change because I anchored for 12 years and tried to have no side or bias or anything in what I reported. And still, I think I am in commentaries pretty much free of any right or left orientation. I've always described myself as a member of the extreme center.
Do you see the extreme center as being neutral and unbiased, or being a political point of view as opinionated as the left or the right, only it's in the middle?
I argue in the book, in Peril and Promise, that the old ideological extremes are out of date in the United States, that the old ideological labels don't mean much anymore, that a lot of the steam has gone out of traditional conservatism in the United States. The Cold War is over. The New Deal and its successor programs on the left, I think, have run out of energy and steam some time ago. And I think what I'm arguing is for a kind of new pragmatism that would not have these old labels of the past.
I guess what I'm thinking, too, and this is to paraphrase something that David Halberstam once wrote, that there in the news, being in the center is seen as being neutral, but it's a point of view as much as any other. I wonder if you'd agree with that.
Well, I think I understand what he's saying, and that is that you get good ideas here, there, and everywhere that could be put into legislation or into policies. And I think that being in the center, it's much easier to take things from the extremes or from each side, more than the extremes, and try to make coherent policy or law out of them. So I agree with David on that.
You recommend that we do away with presidential primaries.
Mm-hmm.
What would you replace them with?
Party conventions. The kinds of conventions we had up until about 1960. The conventions that we have today are really not political. The nominee is picked in primaries, in what I call the roll of the dice in the primaries, months before the convention assembles, and it's a sham convention. And Terry, we are the only democracy in the world that uses elections to choose candidates for the highest office. So I recommend their abolition.
Well, you say that you think the excitement won out of presidential campaigns after Goldwater and LBJ in 1964?
Yeah.
Now, you were arrested at the Republican convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco in 64.
Detained is the word my mother used.
Would you refresh our memories about what happened?
Well, no, it was just one of those, let's clear the aisles and get the press and the delegates out of the aisles. And somebody sent some sheriff's deputies over, and I had been given a seat by the Arizona delegation, and I wasn't really in the aisle. And so we had a little verbal tussle, and then they walked me out. And about 15 seconds after they walked me out of the Cow Palace in San Francisco, an ashen-faced Chief Sergeant at Arms at the Republican convention turned me around and shoved me back on the floor. He knew they'd made a terrible mistake.
So you didn't feel like you were being singled out by people who were anti-press?
No more than the rest of the press, because that was one of the most singularly anti-press conventions either party has ever had. That was the convention when Eisenhower, and I was standing just below the podium when he said it, when Eisenhower denounced self-serving commentators and columnists. And there was this feral roar from the Goldwater delegates in the hall. And Ike was surprised. I was a little surprised. And I know I looked up at him, and he sort of took a half step back, a little surprised that they were that up against the angry about the press. So I didn't feel singled out. There were 3,000 of us there who were hated in the Cow Palace.
My guest is John Chancellor, and he's an NBC News senior political analyst. He's also the author of a new book, which is called Peril and Promise, A Commentary on America. You covered elections for years. Can we get back to some of the early elections that you covered? Would you describe a little bit what the technology was like, counting and analyzing votes before computers?
Well, what you did was you one and one made two, and you went from there. You had blackboards. You had long yellow pads. It was a lot more fun. It went on all night, and nobody knew how it was going to come out. The 1960 election, in which John F. Kennedy won, was not decided in the Eastern time zone until, 9 in the morning or something like that. We were up all night. One of the problems, and I argue this in the book, is that what Theodore H. White used to call the making of the president has now become the merchandising of the president. And technology has a lot to do with that, Terry. I think you know this. But the idea of campaigns when I first started back in 1952 covering national politics was that you would get crowds who would actually ad oculum, as they taught us in school. They would look at the candidate with their eyeballs. And now it's all gone to television. But in those days, the size of the crowds, the motorcades, the number of people who could be in the stadium, the number of people who were at the airport, or in 1952, in many cases, the railroad station, were very important. There were a few polls, but not very many. The polling really got started in about 60, the serious and sophisticated polling.
John Chancellor is my guest, and he's written a new book called Peril and Promise, A Commentary on America. During the 12 years that you anchored, did you feel the pressure of consultants and audience research? And I think there's been much more of a premium placed on audience research and media consultants in recent years.
No, I don't think so. And, you know, in looking back on it, in a rapidly changing world, being a television network anchorman is a job with a lot of job security. Cronkite did it, I think, for 16 years. Huntley and Brinkley were together for almost that long, or maybe that long. I did it for 12 years. For much of the time when I was anchoring, NBC was second to CBS in the ratings. Both Walter and I were, and are, middle-aged professorial men of no great particular sex appeal. Sorry, Walter, if you're listening, but that's true. They kept us on because we were not influenced by, or the networks were not influenced by consultants who would say, put a pretty face on there, by the audience ratings, people who might say, or some programmers who would say, do anything to become number one. And this, I think, to a great extent, extends today into Rather and Jennings and Brokaw.
How did you define your job as anchor? I mean, beyond what we saw when we tuned in the news, what were you doing behind the scenes as the news developed during the day? You were the editor of the show as well, weren't you?
Yeah, well, pretty much the editor, but you never... The titles managing editor or editor and all of that really indicate that you're part of a team. It's usually a team of four or five people, sometimes only three, who really have the ultimate decision on what goes on the program in what order. And I was part of that team, and I suppose because I was an anchor, certainly in the later years, I could pick the lead of the program and do that. The fun of anchoring, for me at any rate, always was putting the program together. Reading the introductions to other correspondents on the air was secondary to me. I enjoyed the struggle to get to put into a 22-minute package the important and meaningful news of the day and see to it that it got reported well. That was the fun.
How did you get your first TV job?
I got the job in television because I had been... I can't think of the word that they use today, but there was a big economy wave at the Chicago Sun-Times where I was a reporter. And there were about 70 people, editorial employees, let go. And in Chicago was a four-newspaper town, and it was very, very difficult to stay in the newspaper business. I got in the newspaper business because I wanted to write books, and I'm finally getting to that point after 40 years with NBC. So I went over as a summer replacement news writer, and television was just starting to grow then, and so I just stayed on. It was interesting.
This was 1950?
Yeah.
Had you seen much television?
Nope.
You had a TV, didn't you?
Nope.
You didn't own a TV?
9% of American homes had television in 1950. In today's dollars, those sets probably cost $2,000 or $3,000. By the end of the decade, in 1960, the price had come way down. By then, I had a television set, and there were television sets in, I think, 93% of American homes. But when I went to work for NBC, the sets were in either the living rooms of the upper middle class and the wealthy or in saloons.
Did that affect at all the way you programmed, the way you reported?
Not on the news. We were actually making it up then because there hadn't been anything before 1950 really called a network television news. And there really wasn't then right that particular year. So we didn't have anything to compare our work with, and we went ahead and simply designed various techniques that most of them are in place today. We invented the damn thing.
I guess it was 1957, you covered the Little Rock story where
I did.
Governor Orville Forbes was trying to prevent the desegregation of schools. Did you realize at that time the impact that television was going to have on the civil rights movement? This was going to be the first time where people described the war in Vietnam as being the first war that was in our living rooms, and the argument could be made it was really the civil rights movement where we Americans sat in our living rooms and we watched, you know, the dogs being unleashed on demonstrators, and we watched cops coming in and dragging people away. Did you have a sense of what television was going to mean in the civil rights movement?
We did indeed. The civil rights movement had been going since about 1954, 55, so we'd had 2 years of covering what some of us called school news in the South, and we knew exactly what role television played, and it is this, that the media, and television is part of that, do not have the power to initiate social change in a country like the United States or indeed in any other country. What the media do is to accelerate and amplify the pace of social change if there's a good case for it. There was a great deal of social turmoil in the South in the United States about desegregation in the middle 1950s, and we knew full well, I'd been doing that for a couple of years, that what television did is it made that change move more quickly. It attracted more people into it, pro and con. And I knew that when I got to Little Rock. I didn't know that they were going to call out the National Guard to stop the black children from going into the school. But we knew then full well the power of television in showing news and communities back to the people who lived in those communities. That was well known then.
You anchored the Today Show for about a year?
Year and a half, I suppose. 14 months, I think.
I assume that since you didn't stay long, you probably didn't like it very much?
Hated it is the word.
Why?
Well, it wasn't journalism, as far as I was concerned, with musical acts and things like that. I had done it against my will. NBC had turned the program over to the news department, and the news department at NBC picked me, a young foreign correspondent, to do it. And I went in kicking and screaming and went out kicking and screaming 14 months later.
In the years that you were anchoring, did a president ever call up and offer an opinion or a complaint about the way you or one of the reporters had handled a story? And if so, I wonder how you responded to it.
No, presidents don't call you with that. Their press secretaries do sometimes. Other members of the White House staff. Jimmy Carter called me once during the Wisconsin primary of 1980. I was in Milwaukee in a little newsroom we'd set up out there, and he called, and the White House operator came on and said, Mr. Chancellor, and I said, yes, and she said, the president wants to talk to you, and I thought, oh, I know what this is about. This is about the hostages. And he's trying to put a certain kind of spin on some news that's coming about the hostages in Iran. And so he came on and he said, "Hello, John." And I said, "How are you, Mr. President?" And he said, "Fine, I want to talk to you off the record." And I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. President, but we have a rule around here that if we think that taking some information from anybody off the record, including presidents, is going to tie our hands at covering an important story, we can't take that information. And I sense, sir, that you're going to talk to me about the hostages, but I can't take it on off the record. So I'm sorry." So there was a long pause, and he said, "I'll tell you anyway."
Yeah?
That's the end of the story.
Oh. So what did he tell you?
Nothing
you hung
important.
Up? Oh. Nothing you want to repeat or nothing important?
Nothing important.
So why was he calling you?
Oh, he wanted to spin the story on the hostages a little bit to his advantage, and what he told me, it wasn't even news.
And so what did you tell him?
I said, "Thank you," and we never even used it. I can't remember the little tiny details, but it was not important news. We didn't even use it on the nightly news that night. Nor did we say, puffing ourselves up, that the president himself called with this information. It just didn't advance the story. It only advanced his candidacy in the Wisconsin primary, and so we just ignored it.
Can you discuss a story that raised the ethical question of whether this story should be killed because it might threaten national security, or whether it should be broadcast because you had the information and wanted to give it to the American public?
Well, we've had a lot of information about that we haven't broadcast over the years. Some of it I really regret. There was the Glomar Explorer, the CIA ship that was built to bring a sunken Soviet submarine off the floor of the Pacific Ocean. And we were asked not to do anything about that, even though the Russians knew about it. I think that was a mistake because the Russians knew all about it. But we should have run that story. There was another that I knew about back in 1979, which can be told now safely, and that is that we learned that not all the American hostages were where they were supposed to be in Tehran, that some of them had taken refuge in the Canadian embassy. And I knew that, and the New York Times knew it, and a number of other people. I suppose maybe 30, 40 people in all in the press knew it. And we never said anything about it until they were safely out. And then they told that story. So that we can keep secrets, and we have over the years kept a number of them.
When you're keeping a secret like that, are you wondering if the other networks have the information and if they're going to keep it secret too?
You never know.
But it's a risk you take that someone else might go with it, even though you've decided
not to. I don't think the judgment is made that way, though. I think the judgment is made individually by editors and their bosses who say, we accept the argument that this would endanger the lives of people or would endanger national security, and so you make it independently. There isn't any getting together with the Associated Press or the New York Times and saying, let's all get together and not run this. It's all done individually, as I think it should be.
I'm interested in your impression of this. I think there's a certain degree of cynicism now at the anchors who go to the hot spot to report from there, whether it's the earthquake in San Francisco or whether it's South Africa when Nelson Mandela is getting released. I think there's the cynicism of, okay, here come the big shots, and they're going to tell us the real story, as if the reporters there couldn't really give it to us on their own. And as a former anchor and as someone who's not participating in that now, I wonder if you have an opinion about it.
I really don't. I remember taking nightly news to China when Nixon first went in because we knew it would be the dominant story. One of the problems with doing that is if you send an anchor to Prague, the plane hits the Empire State Building in New York and your man is in Prague. It's risky to do that. And I don't know, I saw a lot of that going on in Eastern Europe last year. I haven't seen very much of it going on this year, so it may just have been a passing fancy.
You've been a political analyst for the past few years at NBC. I'm wondering, when you're writing one of the commentaries, is there a sense of how much is enough and how much is too much in terms of being opinionated?
Oh, I don't think so. I think people are, I've done over about 1,000 of these things in 8 years, and I think people are pretty used to what I say. I try not. My rule is that I try not to be personal. I try not to make ad hominem arguments. I try not to say, I don't like Senator Dole because of his blue eyes or something. Actually, I like Senator Dole. But I try not to personalize it, and I still try to search for arguments about why things are right and why things are wrong.
I'm curious. I remember, I guess it was after you stopped anchoring and when you became an analyst, pronunciation of your name seemed to shift from Chancellor to Chancellor.
Well, we've always said Chancellor, and the announcers got a hold of it and began making it sound a little more oratorical at the end than I did. But I pronounce it Chancellor.
Well, why was there a shift in pronunciation in the way that the announcers were doing it? Had you asked for that?
No. I had started saying... when I stopped anchoring, I began to be allowed to say my own name. When you're an anchor, you can't say your own name. The announcer says it.
I see. Uh-huh.
And so when they heard me say Chancellor, they began saying Chancellor and stuff like that. I got a lot of ribbing from my friends, and it went away.
Well, John Chancellor, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
John Chancellor is the senior political analyst for NBC News. He's written a new book titled Peril and Promise, A Commentary on America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.